So good morning. This is Chair Rena Moran. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote hearing of the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll for attendance.
Chair Moran?
Present.
Moran, present. Vice Chair Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Garofalo?
Present.
Garofalo, present. Representative Albright, excused. Representative Becker Finn?
Present.
No.
Becker Finn, present. Representative Bernardi? Representative Bernardi? Representative Eklund, excused. Representative Hansen? Representative Hansen? Representative Hassan?
Present.
Hassan, present. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, present.
Hertas, present. Representative Hornstein?
Present.
Hornstein, present. Representative Johnson?
Present.
Johnson, present. Representative Kreisha?
Present.
Kreisha, present. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Liebling, present. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, present.
Lilly, present. Representative Mariani, excused. Representative Marquardt?
Present.
Marquardt, present. Representative Miller?
Miller, present.
Miller, present. Representative Nash?
Nash, present.
Nash, present. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, present.
Nelson, present. Representative Noor?
Noor, present.
Noor, present. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, present.
Pawlowski, present. Representative Petersburg, excused. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Pinto, present. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Schumacher, present. Representative Schultz?
Present.
Schultz, present. Representative Scott?
Present.
Scott, present. Representative Sundin?
Present.
Sundin, present. Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Hansen? That concludes the roll. There is a quorum present.
Great. A quorum is present. So our first agenda item is approval of the minutes from our hearing on Tuesday, April the 6th. The minutes were included in the hearing documents emailed to you by committee staff. Are there any questions or corrections on the minute? If not, the chair will entertain a motion to approve.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Olson, Vice Chair Olson moves approval of the minutes for April the 6th, 2021. Please unmute briefly for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So members, this week, Ways and Means is in the spotlight. Our finance committee committees did an incredible amount of work last week to bill and pass their budget bills. And we will be moving all of those out to the floor in the days ahead. I want to set some expectations for how we will do our work as a committee. I will be asking each of our chairs to present their bills in 5 to 10 minutes, which will include a walkthrough of their spreadsheets and highlighting what they believe are the most important provisions of their bill, including how their budget will build equity and inclusion for all Minnesotans. Some chairs will also have amendments to make technical corrections or to make sure their spending matches their target. We will then move to questions and discussions from members. I want to make sure that members understand that our role in Ways and Means is to review the work of our finance committees, not to redo it. We want to understand the decisions that our chairs made with their targets and make sure that the math adds up. But their bills represent 3 months of hearings and debates by their committee, so I hope we will respect that work. In some cases, we will need to merge bills so that they are correctly aligned with the conference committee structures agreed with the Senate. I will explain that process in greater detail later, but today when we combine our veteran budget with the state government omnibus bill, you will hear a little bit more about that process. So today we have five bills on the agenda, and we're going to try to average about 30 minutes per bill so we can finish for today around noon. Starting tomorrow, we will begin our hearings at 9 o'clock each day and then recess at 10:30 for floor session. Staff will provide members with the schedule updates throughout the week. And so with that, our first bill is House File 1077, which is the housing budget bill. Vice Chair Olson, you are a member of the Housing Committee. Would you like to move the bill on behalf of Chair Hausman?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1077 be recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you. We have the bill before us. Chair Hausman, welcome to the committee. You do have an author's amendment, but if you can please tell us about your bill first, we will come back to the amendment. Chair Hausman.
Sorry, didn't unmute. Thank you, Representative Olson and Representative Moran. Having a safe and stable home is the foundation for well-being and achievement in nearly all other areas of life. Lack of stable housing has negative impacts on economic security, health outcomes, and educational achievement. This bill provides funding to a variety of programs aimed at helping produce more affordable housing in Minnesota, as well as provisions to ensure Minnesotans are safely and stably housed. More than 572,000 Minnesota households pay more than they can afford for housing. That equates to more than one in every four households in the state. In general, Minnesota is not producing housing at a level that will eliminate our housing shortage. Additionally, the current market largely builds for higher income households. Because of this, there is a projected supply gap of more than 65,000 units for renter households that are affordable at or below 30% area median income. The Housing Omnibus Bill was put together with a focus on supporting Minnesotans throughout the housing continuum, the whole continuum, helping people find secure and stable housing and to prevent homelessness, increasing the amount of affordable and workforce housing statewide, and increasing access to homeownership for all Minnesotans. We received a target of $30 million, most of it being one-time funding. Obviously, that's not enough for the crisis we're facing, but we did the best we could. The programs that were funded over base, and I'll say a little more about these as I move, the Challenge Program, the Manufactured Home Park Infrastructure Grants, Workforce Home Ownership Program, Homework Starts with Home, Bridges, which is the rental assistance for individuals with serious mental illness, the Home Ownership Assistance Fund, the Home Ownership Education, Counseling, and Training Fund, Local Housing Trust Fund, the NOAA Grant Program, Naturally Occurring Affordable Housing, I'll say a little more about that later, Lead Safe Homes, and the Shelter Provider Task Force. There are a number of bills that we incorporated into the omnibus bill that specifically focus on bringing balance to the landlord-tenant relationship. This sentence is a really important one for you to understand. In Minnesota, evictions move quickly. We are one of only seven states that does not require a notice before filing an eviction. We tend to think of Minnesota as leading the charge, not in this area. And so we've got some work to do. There are also a few measures related to manufactured homes, which provide some of the most affordable homeownership opportunities on the market. In addition to the bill's funding to improve park infrastructure, it also includes titling reform provisions to make it easier for owners to access traditional mortgage financing, as well as Representative Bernardi's opportunity to purchase bill, which gives people who own manufactured homes the opportunity to purchase the land their home sits on. They own the, the home but not the land it sits on. When it is put up for sale to try to prevent the land from literally being sold out from under them. What we've learned is most of these homes, when they go up for sale, are being purchased by out-of-state buyers. So this is an affordable type of home. The other affordable housing is naturally occurring affordable housing. We call it NOAA, which we are told is half the cost of building new. If we can find and save it before a developer finds it and upgrades it and raises the rents, that becomes a very, very affordable type of home. There's also a section in here establishing the LeadSafe grant program, which would seek to test for and remove harmful chemicals from the paint in homes all over the state, with a particular focus on areas where children experience high rates of lead poisoning. This is a bill MICA has been working on for years, and I'm proud to include that piece in this bill. While there is so much to celebrate about the work Minnesota does related to housing and homeownership, we know that outcomes in these areas don't look the same in every community. Minnesota has one of the worst racial disparities in homeownership. The programs and policies contained in this bill make critical investments to help close that homeownership gap, to prevent displacement, to ensure evictions don't unnecessarily block families from affordable housing opportunities for years, and to make sure all homes are safe. I'll say just a bit more about a few of the programs that where we're increasing funding. The Challenge Program, the goal of this program is to help provide the workforce housing needed to enhance economic development. Homework Starts with Home is a grant program conducted in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and the Interagency Council on Homelessness. It supports collaborative efforts between schools, housing organizations, and local governments to identify, engage, and stabilize students experiencing homelessness and their families. The Homeownership Assistance Fund provides interest-free deferred loans for down payment and closing costs for income-eligible first-time buyers. Minnesota Housing is required to collect applicant demographic information on a voluntary basis to help better understand and address the disparity gap in homeownership. The Homeownership Education, Counseling, and Training Program provides homeowner education and counseling services grants to community-based organizations to help prepare a buyer for success long-term through the provision of full-cycle homeownership services to low- and moderate-income Minnesotans that assist through all phases of purchasing and keeping a home. This includes services for new home buyers, those looking to refinance, and those at risk of foreclosure. And one more program to talk about, the one I referenced earlier, naturally occurring affordable housing. Most often are multi-unit rental properties that remain affordable for modest income households without subsidies. NOAA is the largest source of affordable housing in Minnesota, but also the one at greatest risk of redevelopment. It provides grants and loans to NOAA property owners who have a demonstrated experience owning and operating quality and well-managed affordable housing. The funds must be used to acquire and rehabilitate a NOAA property otherwise determined to be at risk of experiencing increasing rents and tenant displacement. That's just a little bit of a flavor of those areas where we are increasing the funding. And did you want to take up the amendment?
Yeah, well, thank you, Chair Hausman. Vice Chair, would you care to move the A6 author's amendment for Chair Hausman?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the A6 amendment.
So the A6 is before us. Chair Hausman, could you please explain the amendment?
Thank you, Representative Olson and Representative Moran. This was a very last minute. Traveling separately is a bill that's already here in Ways and Means that provides an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium. When the eviction moratorium ends, we want to avoid chaos and mass evictions. And so there's a separate bill that provides for this. Only this weekend did we get the fiscal note for that. It's $44,000 to the Minnesota Supreme Court for increased cases. Leadership decided this weekend that they wanted to include it in this budget bill. So This is to match up with the Senate and keep it in housing. And then there's one technical sentence that was added at our House research suggestion.
All right. Members, are there any questions on the amendment? If not, Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Moran, we do have some hands up.
Okay, let me open that up. Who do we have, Chris?
Representative Scott.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Chair Houseman, thank you for the explanation of that 44,000. It wasn't, like you said, it was last minute. We didn't hear this in the Judiciary Committee that there was going to be funding for this off-ramp. I'm all for giving more money to the courts. I'm not sure they're going to need it based on what we're hearing from the industry, is that most people are paying their rent. And so I don't know how much of a flood the courts are actually going to see. I had questions more along the lines on 1.11 through 1.14 and the new language there, and I'm wondering if the author could explain that language and why it was added.
And if Mary Mullen is on, my understanding is that is a technical amendment that she caught. So if Mary Mullen is on the phone, I would have her.
Ms. Mullen.
Thank you, Chair and members. That language comes from the advocates for the bill, and they asked that it be included. It prevents, there are two provisions in the bill that are to protect, primarily were brought by university students who are experiencing difficulty with leases. And so that prevents those provisions from being waived.
Mm. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we're adding policy again in a finance committee, and I'm opposed to that language. I understand these university students, a lot of them, it's the first time they're renting and so forth, but there are a number of ways for them to get help with their leases. They even have an on-campus housing advocate that they can go see. And so I think this language is not necessary, and I will be encouraging members to vote against this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments and questions are to the underlying bill.
Okay. Representative Hertas.
I would concur. My comments and questions are for the underlying bill.
All right. I would come back to both of you. If there's no other questions, Vice Chair Olson renews her motion to adopt the A6 amendment, author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Members, are there any other questions for Chair Houseman? And I think we have a couple. So I'm going to start with Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Houseman, as you know, I have a great passion for housing and was just wondering a couple of things. I believe it was 2018 gubernatorial task force, we found that there are approximately, 100,000 homes behind in the state of Minnesota. And I was wondering, are you working to address that? Are you trying to also look at the impact of things like zoning and inspection fees and various other fees as it relates to the increase of cost in housing and what that impact is to the overall marketplace and availability of housing to people who are trying to create a stable home and a stable place for themselves within the community? Because as I remember it, I believe those are fairly costly increases that get layered into the cost of a home. And for every $1,000 of increased price, it prices out 4,000 people from the market. So those are potentially heavily impact decisions that municipalities make. So just wondering if you could give me some illumination on the efforts that your committee took to address those issues.
So members, there is a school of thought driven by one particular interest group that believes if we just got rid of regulations, codes, and fees, they could build affordable housing. I will tell you the biggest opponents of that are all of the cities around the state, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Metro Cities, who believe that is a very kind of shallow approach. What we believe, two of the things that I talked about as I described the bill, manufactured home parks are affordable housing, naturally occurring affordable housing that we can find and save is the least expensive housing. I'm convinced that different housing models and different ways of construction are the way to begin to close this gap. There's something called modular construction, and there is a building going up, I think it might be in St. Paul, using modular construction, a very much less expensive way to build. Tiny houses, Representative Olson has a bill that unfortunately we couldn't fund in this one. I'm hoping it gets funded in the bonding bill for a dormitory. It's kind of like the rooming house model where you have your privacy, you have your bedroom and bathroom, but then you share some mutual spaces. And the advantage of that is you live in community. You don't live in isolation. And so I'm hoping we can find a way to fund, when she presented that in committee, it was on a bipartisan basis, really strongly supported.
Representative Nance.
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Hausman. I'm going to disagree with you that it's just one single group, because I will tell you, while Housing First does advocate for this, respectfully, Chair, I've spoken to hundreds of homeowners. I've talked to hundreds of builders and various people who work in the industry adjacent to the creation of stable homes. So it's not a narrow group, Madam Chair. It is actually quite diverse and quite wide. And there have been a number of very strong pieces of research, one again from the gubernatorial task force in 2018. And I will tell you that in my district, out here in Carver County, there are not a lot of what we call starter homes being built anymore. And as you begin to peel back the onion, Madam Chair, you begin to see that very often because of zoning decisions that municipalities make and decisions that they make also as to how they handle various fees that they will levy to the homeowner, that is driving the decrease in the availability for homes. And I certainly appreciate your interest in creating tiny homes and dormitories, but that's not going to solve the issue. That is not even going to come close to solving the issue. We have to address a problem. And burying our heads in the sand and turning blithely to the two municipal interest groups who are diametrically opposed to change isn't going to help either. So, Madam Chair, I respectfully will tell you that this is not a proper approach. This is not a good approach. This is something that you're basically trying to kick the can down the road and blame people who are building homes for being greedy or being whatever else you'd like to assign to them. But those assignations fall hollow. And I know for a fact that talking to people who are outside of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, that they would like to have a nice, stable home that they can afford, that doesn't have prerequisites that effectively force them to put various things on the outside of their home or build out of certain materials. They would like the flexibility to develop on various different sizes of lots, and that the developer gets to have a bigger say in this. So again, Madam Chair, while you choose to ignore the impact of or the insight from these housing groups, just because you say it isn't true doesn't make it so. So members, I think this is short-sighted. There are families that are looking to create what I call true north in their lives. My oldest son turns 25 yesterday. He tells me regularly, Dad, I'm pleased to know that there is always that place in Waconia that I can go to that is always home. That was created and is sustained by stable housing stock. We have to build more, and we have to address the issue of fees and zoning requirements that are put forward by cities. And to not include that is exceptionally short-sighted. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Chair Houseman, I don't know if you want to respond or not. We can go on to the next.
I would say just go on to the next.
Representative Hertas.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members, and Representative Houseman. Thank you for your work on this bill. I want to talk a little bit about manufactured housing, but before I do so, I just wanted to support some of the comments that Representative Nash made. And I'd like to just point out some of the intrinsic problems with the seemingly inconsequential add-ons to the requirements of building new homes and what that means for the consumer. Madam Chair and Representative Houseman, as I've mentioned in the years past, I've erected hundreds of homes in the Twin Cities, and I can speak firsthand to the changes that have occurred over the last many decades with regard to the cost of erecting new homes. I have previously mentioned the Met Council's influence on land use and the tight supply of land with regard to building homes on properties has driven the price of land in our metro region quite high. In fact, land represents nearly 30% of the cost of the home today. Madam Chair, I grew up in a first suburban ring suburb of St. Louis Park, where there was a home every 50 feet. As a developer, I can tell you that if I came into any growing fringe community, second or third suburban ring, that if I came in with a proposal to have a development with 50-foot lots and modest homes, I'd be laughed right out of City Hall. The zoning regulations are relevant, and we do little or nothing to provide opportunities for the so-called life cycle housing, opportunities for people to enter the housing market. In addition, Minnesota is an outlier with regard to collecting mortgage registration tax and state deed tax on every real estate transaction, particularly residential ones, add thousands of dollars to the cost of a transaction. In addition to that, I'd like to point out some of the mortgage complexities and the qualifying ratios. When we're talking about the low rate of home ownership among minorities and the income necessary to support a new mortgage, from the real estate side, from the sales side perspective, every time you raise the price of a home $1,000, qualifying ratios using 28 or 33%, those are nomenclature within the real estate industry in terms of getting customers to be qualified. But for every $1,000, when you finance that on a 30-year mortgage, that increases the price of that home 3.5 times that cost. So a $1,000 increase over the life of the mortgage ends up being $3,000 or more. More importantly, the income necessary to support every $1,000 of additional increase in cost increases the income requirement in a manner which far exceeds the $1,000. So costs and fees and code enforcement and having special interest groups who lobby the legislature to make sure that their service or their product is included in the construction of a new home exponentially adds to the cost. So I'll end that with regard to costs. Representative Nash is exactly right about addressing this. It's an important component of lowering the cost of housing. To the manufactured housing issue, I will also tell you that communities, by and large, don't like these in their community, and they would just as soon see them out of existence. And they view manufactured housing, which I too acknowledge, Representative Houseman, is a very affordable housing opportunity other than subsidizing rents and having Section 8 housing. This is an opportunity for people at a minimum level to get started in building equity in a piece of property and to pay off that debt and be able to sell it and take that money and use it as a down payment for a home that's actually part of a neighborhood that is permanent. I've introduced legislation, and it's part of the tax bill, which lowers the underlying tax rate on manufactured home parks, and I'm happy that that's included. That was kind of all over the board with regard to different manufactured home parks, and there are about 46,000 manufactured home residents that will benefit by addressing that issue. But taxing commercial mobile home parks as commercial property and using tax rates encourage their development and getting rid of them, and that's what cities like to see. They view many of these mobile home parks as blight in their community, and that's unfortunate because there's many very high-quality mobile home parks. In the bill, there's a provision that is troublesome, and that is the non-contractual right of first refusal. If a mobile home park goes up for sale, mobile home residents under this bill and under this language would have a right to intercede in a real estate transaction conferring or changing ownership of the mobile home park. Now, the problem with that is in the real estate community and in real estate brokerage, we owe a duty of confidentiality to our clients. And what this bill does is requires disclosure of the terms and conditions of that certain purchase agreement, which violates every aspect of real estate duties as far as a licensed agent. We cannot put sold on a property until it actually closes. You can't list it as sold in the MLS. And having knowledge of a pending transaction and the terms and the price and the conditions violates some of those basic duties to the client. Furthermore, I've been made aware of certain transactions that have occurred of recent where it was really a developer who used residents of a mobile home park as a wedge, if you will, to intercede in trying to compete against another developer who had a better vision of creating affordable housing and housing opportunities and diversity in a mobile home park. And I won't get into the nitty-gritty of that detail, but it was really quite troubling to see that the mobile home resident is being used as a pawn in kind of a high-stakes real estate finance game of acquiring property. Furthermore, the one project I'm referring to was actually encouraged by the city to be developed, then was totally disrupted. But anyway, this is problematic. A mobile home co-op or organization could certainly, in advance of any sale, have a agreement or an option agreement to be the first right of refusal. And if the mobile home park owner decides that it's time for him to move on and to convey the property to someone else, that certainly could be an option to provide it in advance. But if a mobile home park owner should have a more capitalized potential buyer who's going to put money into the park and make it better, to have this language in this bill that allows them, without any other interest in the property, to simply intercede and have first right of refusal after a purchase agreement has been executed is just wrong. And so for this reason, Madam Chair, I'm not going to be able to support the bill today. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hausman, Chair Hausman, for putting this bill together. I just have a simple question. You had mentioned about tiny houses, and I know my daughter and her friends and quite frankly, I think her generation really are looking at that as a new affordable housing option. And they're not interested in really being in a big mobile home park. They're more interested in putting that on a tract of land where they could, as they put it, kind of have a communal, you know, maybe two or three little tiny houses and a little garden and maybe a couple chickens and things. I'm just relaying my daughter's generation of needs. And so is there anything in this bill that would further the ability for, you know, someone of my daughter's generation to actually put together a little tiny home, not a mobile home park, but a little tiny home community on a tract of land? Because it seems to me, as she was describing the impediments, is there's so many ordinances across the state that prohibit that. So what is this bill doing to help move forward that initiative, since you did mention tiny houses?
Chair Houseman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, unfortunately, does not do very much in that area. We talk about it as a housing model to encourage it, but there are cities that have made some breakthroughs. What you describe is, I think it's either Oregon or Washington, where they have communities that they build their houses around a common space, and then they share that common space, the outdoors. I've long thought where the Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant used to be, the we call it TCAP, a massive amount of space. Imagine the most beautifully designed tiny house village, but massive amounts of land that then would be available for parks and walking paths and community gardens where they could grow healthy food. So we have conversations around it, but we have a long ways to go, I think, in terms of developing the tiny house concept.
Mm. Representative Neal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm so disappointed that there isn't something in here, because if you talk about affordable housing, I mean, there isn't much more affordable than, I mean, it's kind of like an RV in a way, but it's, they're so interesting. They're so unique. They're so, each one is so unique and different. And it's something that my daughter and her friends have been talking to me about for years now. And it's all the rage in their generation. So I was really hoping there'd be something in this bill that would move the needle forward. And, you know, I'm not really talking about like, you know, like a trailer home park or like a community necessarily, but just allowing them to find their own little piece of land and to just do this. But anyway, so hope's dashed again. So sorry.
Totally
sorry,
agree.
Olivia, there's nothing in the bill for you.
Totally agree.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I give closing comments on our side, or is there anyone else who wishes to speak?
You are the last.
All right, thank you. Chair Houseman, it is well documented that we have costs of housing issues in Minnesota compared to our border states. So, for example, when there's new construction, whether it's residential, whether it's apartments, if we can compare the cost of construction in Woodbury to Hudson, Duluth to Superior, Moorhead to Fargo, that it just costs more to build things in Minnesota than our neighboring states. We're not talking about the land costs. Obviously, that's going to be wide variables. But what are we doing in this bill that's going to actually lower those input costs for builders? You mentioned before the housing first concerns, but it's pretty well documented that higher costs that exist just to construct something outside of land costs. What is in this bill that's going to reduce those that regulatory and governmental pressure and upward costs?
Chair Houseman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We don't, that's been a debated premise. I don't buy into it, and so it's just not an issue that I have been involved in.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Houseman, when you say that that's a debated premise, what is a debated premise?
Chair Houseman.
Simply put, the premise is that if we just reduced regulations, codes, and fees, that developers could build affordable housing. There are many, many advocacy groups in housing, including all the cities across the state, who have countered that. And so we've spent a lot of time talking about that, and it's a debate that's ongoing.
Okay, but Madam Chair, Chair Moran and Representative Houseman, but the fact that construction costs in bordering cities in other states I don't think there's any dispute on that, though, is there? I mean, there's an agreement that if you build an identical building in Woodbury versus Hudson, you account for the difference in land costs, that it just costs more to build the same building in Wisconsin. I mean, that's not debatable, is it?
That has been disputed, yes.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, you said that isn't
disputed? That has been disputed. I'm sorry, Representative Moran.
It has been disputed, yes.
Okay, so Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, how about in the Fargo-Moorhead area? Are there people actually disputing that identical construction it's more costly in Minnesota than in North Dakota? Are there people who are in the housing denial business as well?
So what you're talking about, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, there's something about this remotely that it's hard for me to wait to have the chair recognize it. We are talking about one very narrow niche, which is market rate housing. That area, by the way, is not broken. People who can afford to buy market rate housing are already homeowners.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, I would dispute that characterization. We have lots of market rate housing issues. I suppose it depends upon the design of the market and what people consider to be the market. But what I'm talking about, Representative Hausman, is the fact that we have retail information on home sales. We have inputs of construction. Obviously, if you're building something in Fargo and you're building something in Moorhead, your labor costs should be relatively identical. The emphasis on the word should be. The product materials they're using across the other side of the river are not going to be substantially different than the ones they're using in Minnesota. And so when we have documented instances of higher costs in housing, not land costs, but of higher construction costs, it is interesting that there seems to be this level of housing denial that people don't want to accept the fact that Minnesota policies drive up the cost. Now, whether those costs are justified or not, that's a debatable proposition we can all have. But we do, in the government of the state of Minnesota and our local units of government, we do make housing more expensive. That's what we do. And then what happens is the government regulations come in, drive up the cost of things, and then we want to have government come in on the other hand and subsidize it for select industries and select areas to lower the costs. And I think what you're seeing from those in the industry and you're seeing from those on our side of the aisle is an increasing concern about affordability. And so I don't think that it's, as Representative Nash mentioned, I don't think it's fair to characterize this as one issue with one group of businesses. I mean, these are documented facts. It goes beyond housing. We can't build anything in this state anymore, whether it's pipelines, energy, infrastructure, housing, everything's more expensive. And so I'll be voting no on the bill today. I would encourage members to vote no. But Representative Hausman, I suspect the reason why it's difficult for us to communicate is you miss seeing my lovely face and interacting with me on a one-on-one basis. So I look forward to seeing you in person. And thank you again. Members, I'll be voting no.
Mm. Well, with that, Representative Garofalo, I don't think there's any further discussion to the bill. So I want to thank Chair Hausman for her work in housing and remind members why this issue is so important. It is truly important. With that, I'd like to just leave the last word with Chair Hausman.
I will just thank you for your time. I think we've used up our committee time, so I just appreciate your support.
All right. So there being no further discussion, Vice Chair Olson renews her motion that House File 1077, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any necessary technical corrections. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Yes.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright, excused. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Sun, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha?
Kreisha, no.
Kreisha, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt votes aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg, excused. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. 18 ayes, 9 nays.
So there have been 18 ayes and 9 nays. The motion prevails. House File 1077, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. And nonpartisan staff are directed to make any necessary technical corrections again. Thank you, Chair Houseman.
Thank you.
So our next bill is House File 1079, which is the legacy budget. As a reminder, this bill did not have any general funds dollars in its target since it uses dedicated funding sources. Chair Lilly, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move that your bill be recommended for placement on the general register? And then tell us about your bill, and then we can come back to your amendment.
Thank you, Chair Moran. I'd like to move that House File 1079 be placed on the general register.
Thank you. To your bill.
Thank you, Chair Moran and committee members. Good morning. This is the legacy finance bill. I'm excited to be before you this morning. In 2008, the voters of Minnesota chose to start a 25-year tax on themselves, passing the Clean Water Legacy and Amendment. And so 0.375% of this of the sales tax in Minnesota since then has gone into protecting our state's outdoor heritage, clean water, parks and trails, and cultural heritage. Just to be clear, that decision has been really popular and envy around the whole country. But these funds have been hard working for Minnesota. And since 2010, almost $2 billion have gone towards making Minnesota an even a better place than it is already. And so it's pretty exciting. As a committee, we worked really hard to make sure that this money is going to benefit, all of Minnesota and all of these funds. So we greatly enhance protecting the waters, restoring habitat, building parks and trails, supporting diverse and changing community to go after to better serve that area. And it's a super exciting bill. The bill is almost $650 million, and we've been pretty lucky as a state because, one of the upsides of COVID is people have, as we've all heard on the news, are home spending maybe and buying stuff on the internet, and so sales tax have gone up, and so we've seen an increase in these funds, and it's going back to Minnesotans and helping. About a third of this bill is made up of extensions. We had a lot of problems, as you know, the rest of government and the rest of, you know, people have just had trouble with COVID. So we're trying, we have extensions that'll be almost a third of this whole bill is language that helps organizations that have received monies in the past year. So that's why it's going to seem quite thick as far as the bill goes. Going into the bill itself, starting with the legacy or Lessard Sams rather piece of the fund, 33% of these funds go towards that. And Lessard Sams is funded every other year. So it's we'll have a bill this year and then have a bill next year too. But it's about $131 million this year going into projects all over the state of Minnesota, making for habitat improvements and restoration projects. And this is, there's a Lessard Sams Council, and Representative Becker Finn and Representative Heitzman serve ably as members from our body and with the Citizen Council, and they come forward with recommendations, and we really stuck to the recommendations quite strongly. With the surplus, there was a little bit extra money on the bottom line, so we decided to go after adding to the grants program that's available, and just to reach out to some groups that have never been recognized in the past, and to go after aggressively to try to reach out to these groups that have not received funding in the past. But it's a great bill, and you know, we got great citizens doing good work on there, and please take a look at it. It's they do a lot of work. It's a binder. Representative Becker Finn and Heitzman can tell you they have meetings all year round and go into that. We also in the past we added some language because we noticed that they weren't really using Conservation Corps. And we really encourage them to reach out to Conservation Corps to get more kids involved and reaching out to more diverse, encouraging them to do and get more kids out involved in these projects. And the hope is that they become interested in these things and choose it as careers. And we're pretty excited about that. Going on to the Clean Water Fund, another third goes to the Clean Water Fund, 33%, and that's funded for the whole biennium. So it's quite a large number. $256 million is going to the clean water area, again, all over the state. It's largely unchanged from the governor and the Clean Water Council recs. So there's good work that's being done, and there's, you know, the, working with partners all over the state, like farmers that are doing good things. You know, the goal is to have our water more swimmable, fishable, and drinkable, and there really is amazing work that's going on. The House got involved in the Environment Committee and then our committee in Legacy, and we, you know, we did some tweaks, not only with the bill, but then again, the growth of the surplus, that the growth in revenue that we found. And we added some programs, you know, some like the River Watch up in Moorhead. We were talking about Moorhead a few seconds ago, and out in Chanhassen, there's a River Watch program that gets kids out involved, and super exciting program. And we put language in also to encourage careers and to have the DNR and these other folks, and they're doing some of it already, but really push them into getting kids out and interested in working on these projects. So I can get more into that later if there's questions. And then the Parks and Trails part, about 14% of the money goes to Parks and Trails. Again, that's about $110 million for the biennium. And there's a kind of a piece in the valley of the between the greater Minnesota folks and the DNR and the metropolitan groups. And they all presented together. It was really pretty neat. And, you know, there's good work connecting people all over state. What we've seen also with COVID is this system-wide is just the interest is huge in these parks and trails and, you know, the wear and tear. I mean, Minneapolis has, you know, 50, 60, you know, just that system alone, just the pressure. And then, you know, I see it over here in the East Metro. And then when I get out in Greater Minnesota, I see just, I mean, we're just hearing stories where the trail use and the wear and tear. So this is a immensely popular program. And if anything, it's overloved and needs further investment. And hats off to all the groups that are really being good stewards on working on the program. So then moving on to the arts and cultural piece of the pie, that's about 19%, almost 19.75%. And that's $150 million. And that's going to, starting off, almost half goes to the arts organizations, from the biggest of Minnesota to the artist you might know that Shwazinski maybe down in you know, if he put in for his welding or I don't know, but Shwazinski, sorry, I said his name wrong, but you know, doing great organizations, and they decide and spread grants all over. I think it's over 1,200 grants go out every biennium. So it's a huge program and immensely popular. And I hope you get an opportunity to look at and see these things are going statewide. And then there's money that goes into some fantastic programs to the, like the zoos, Minnesota Zoo, Como Zoo, the Duluth Zoo, libraries all over Minnesota. And people love their libraries, Ampers, county fairs, public TV, public radio, the Science Museum, and then there's like Wilderness and Quarry, which I just love. It's kind of like that river walk. Gets kids out and just super excited that don't normally have an opportunity to get on the land and get out and discover and get on the water. And I hope you can take a look at, if you have an opportunity to get invited to one of these and see it. The humanities does some great work with us. The Historical Society all over the state, from Split Rock to the you know, down in the prairies of Minnesota. I can't think of that place with the petroglyphs, but it's amazing treasures. But we spun off some. I'm super excited about the bill. We spun off some money for different cultural groups and some really good work. Please take a look at it. And I'm just excited, you know, to see each group. You know, we've grown the program. It was last biennium, we were able to do 1.7. We're up to $7.5 million for cultural groups and just some really great. Just the other day, we, you know, in my amendment, I have a group that I'm super excited about, this 30,000 feet. And if you have a chance to take a look at Chair Lee's committee and capital investment, this group is amazing and they're doing great work with kids. And just one example of what we're able to do in this bill to help these groups. Anyways, there's so many great things in here. I could keep going on. I just love it. I'm sorry. I know we're a little behind agenda with housing, but there's just, I was really, I had a great committee. You know, at first I was wondering if Speaker Dell was messing with Representative Green, but you know, he's a great partner in this too. He asked great questions and we had a great committee on both sides of the aisle. We had a strong bipartisan vote ultimately on this bill coming out of committee. But I'd like to thank our staff, Helen Roberts and Janelle Taylor and Mary Mullen and Brad Hagemeyer. Our nonpartisan staff are amazing. And of course our partisan teams, but anyways, I know we're not supposed to do that here, but probably, but I just am really grateful for our team. And it's, again, it's a good bill. It's solid. I think it's something that Minnesotans can be proud of. And, you know, ultimately it's not that different. I mean, than Mary Representative Murphy started and Gunther and Erdahl and myself and Con kind of got this thing going. And, but I mean, if you look at it, there's some great things for Minnesota, and I'm certain that there's something in here for everybody that you could probably vote for. So thank you for hearing me this morning. I do have an author's amendment. It's the A11, And with the chair's permission, I'd like to move it. It's essentially technical, an amendment. We had some historical society thing that we needed to change. And then we added one of these groups that came to us late. And then, of course, some extensions on some park, but it's a technical amendment. So I'd be, when the chair is ready, I'd like to move the A11, if that's okay.
So just for the record, Chair Moran had to step off the call. So I, Vice Chair, also will be taking over now with the gavel. So yes, Representative Lilly, you can move your A11 amendment.
Thank you. So moved, Chair Olson.
Wonderful. All those in favor, or actually, will you please describe the A11, Representative Lilly?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Olson. I'm sorry, I kind of pre-described it. So it's, just to be clear, it's the A11's a technical, and it really is. It's a historical society. We moved from, they wanted it one fund to another. And then we added a group in the cultural heritage that came to us very late. And then the rest is like a COVID a trail work. I think that was for Representative Murphy up in the Duluth area. Thank you, Chair Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lilly. Any discussion to the A11? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A11, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A11 is adopted. Are there any questions to the bill as amended? Questions or discussion? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the author of the bill accurately stated, the voters in their infinite wisdom in 2006 have constitutionally mandated that we waste this money on an annual basis. So, obviously, there'll be a diversity of opinion on this, but this bill, but I'll be voting no on this today. But I do have a question for Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly, in previous, last year's budget session, or excuse me, 2 years ago, we had the Leadership Tribunal kind of decide the major appropriations bills. Do you know if the legacy bill is going to be under the Leadership Tribunal model, or are you going to be allowed to negotiate this separately outside of leadership?
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Olson and Representative Garofalo. I haven't heard. I haven't heard down from up upon high, but I'm guessing it's just moving forward. It's I'm actually excited to get to, pass it off the House floor and get it to get together with Senator Rood. Work together to hopefully pass this. It's really great work for Minnesota, and I'm just so honored to carry it. And I think it's, I know what you said, but it's, I think it's really neat what we can bring to Minnesota with these funds. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Representative Lilly, I continue to be impressed with the new ways that you continue to describe spending money, particularly neat, and people really like it. So again, I'll be voting no on this, but I understand there'll be a difference of opinion. Thank you.
Is there further discussion to the bill? Well, seeing none, I will Representative O'Neill.
My apologies, Chair. I was checking a fact. I'm wondering if Representative Lilly could just let us know how many acres of land in the state of Minnesota that we'll be buying again. And, I'm originally from northern Minnesota, Clearwater County, and it's really, really difficult for people to make a living up there. I still have lots of friends, former classmates, family that are still up there. And so every time the state of Minnesota buys up more land, it is incredibly hard for farmers to buy more land, for loggers to lease land or buy land. And it just makes it exceptionally harder to survive in greater Minnesota. So Representative Lilly, I'm wondering if you could tell us how many more acres are going to be taken away from the public being able to purchase it, and instead it's going to be in the state rolls, and how much is going to be covered by PILT. So another thing that happens that's really hard is a place like Clearwater County and Mahnomen County, first and second poorest counties in the state of Minnesota, and yet in last I checked, Clearwater County had 37% of their land owned by the state, And I don't know how much of that is covered by PILT, but it is really, really hard for anyone to make a living when we keep, the state keeps buying up land. So how much of this is, are we taking off of the tax rolls? How much is going to be covered by PILT? And how many acres in total are we taking away from my friends, my farmers, my loggers up there from being able to purchase land? Because that's really hard on them.
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Olson and Representative O'Neill. We get this question, as you know, you've served for quite a few years, like myself now, and we hear this question. It's a really good question. I really think the Wasard Sands, particular, that's where most of the land purchases are taking place, has done a good job of moving and to other parts of Minnesota. You know, maybe to the Southwest or the Prairie Zones. Realizing that there's been some land pressures in the north, I think, and so they're trying to move and maybe doing more preservation kind of work up in north and in the north area. You know, one thing to keep in mind when you talk about this is, and it doesn't really answer your question, is that these are lands also for, you know, they're willing sellers. And so there's always that kind of debate, but it's land that people can get on. You know, I'm lucky enough to live on water, but not everybody can. So this is, you know, you're the same people you're talking about can get on the land and be able to do that. But I have Mr. Johnson with me, and maybe he can, he spends every day working on this. Mr. Johnson is with the clean, or not the clean water, but with the Wasard Sands. And he could kind of go through the areas of the X number, because I've got a sheet here, but I don't think it shows the PILT that you asked, and I want to get to that. So just so members know, as he's talking, PILT is payment in lieu of taxes. So it's but Mr. Johnson, are you available to that kind of help us? And
see, Mr. Johnson is there. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Olson and members, for the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the executive director of the Wasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. And Chair Olson, Chair Lilly, and members, in the current bill, the projections for acquisition is actually for, and this is fee title, so they'd be buying the land with PILT. I'm sorry, is 3,879 acres. Without PILT is 2,580 acres. The without PILT is, again, those properties that are going to counties or they're being held and continue to pay taxes on them, local units of government, or in some cases to the federal government for waterfowl protection areas. The PILT lands would be WMA lands, state forest lands, things like that are going to be held by the state. And again, that's about 3,870 acres. As an aside, I don't, if memory serves me correctly, I don't recall any potential fee title acquisitions that will be happening in Clearwater County, but I don't remember Minoman County. My apologies for that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It makes me think of Beltrami County right next door, and I believe 85 or 86% of that county is owned by state or federal. It's just really, really problematic. You know, people are just trying to make a living up there, and this is exceptionally hard on them to do this to them year after year after year. And I would say it's a little bit of a misnomer to say that this is market rate, because in my experience talking with people up there, my friends and my family, classmates, what happens when the state comes in to buy something is they skyrocket the prices. It's two or three times what the normal market rate is. So I would take exception to that as well. I'm going to be an absolute no on this bill, because we need to stop taking land. I don't even know how many millions of acres we already have that were owned by the state, but when is enough enough? That's my question. When have we finally purchased enough? Enough is enough already. We need to start reversing that back and letting it go back to farmers and those that do logging and others that are trying to make the land productive, and stop taking it out of their hands. So I'm an absolute no on this.
Thank you. Further discussion to the bill? Seeing no further discussion, I will turn it over to Representative Lilly for the last word and to renew your motion.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you, committee. You know, like I said, it's in 2008, the voters approved this, and, you know, the number has, the revenue has continued to go up. And it is being well spent by our partners. In the first couple of years, we had a few audit reports, and the groups are really doing a good job of checking themselves to make sure that they're being good stewards of these funds. And I think it's something that we can be proud of. And there's good work all over here. Please take a look at the bill. There's just really neat things from libraries to zoos to these parks and trails that people love. But, you know, I think it's something that we all can be proud of as a state. And there's a lot of good work in the clean water. I mean, getting things more swimmable, drinkable, and fishable just is super great when you think of all the lakes in Minnesota. But anyways, thank you. It's appreciate you hearing the bill this morning, and look forward to further discussion when we get to the floor and beyond.
Well, thank you, Chair Lilly. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Lilly renews his motion that House File 1079, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any necessary technical corrections. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran, excused. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
No.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright, excused. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
No.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha?
Aye.
Kreisha, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg, excused. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. 18 ayes, 8 nays.
There being 18 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. House File 1079, as amended, is recommended to be for placement on the General Register, and nonpartisan staff are directed to make any necessary technical corrections. Thank you, Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Thank you. And with that, the next two bills on the agenda will be merged by motion. We'll be using this process a few times this week, so I want to just quickly explain how this will work. We'll hear each bill that is being combined one at a time and adopt any necessary amendments for each one. Then we'll vote to incorporate the language of each bill as separate articles into whichever House file is serving as the omnibus, followed by a final roll call vote to move the combined bill to the General Register. So next we'll hear and lay over the Veterans and Military Affairs Bill. And then after that, we'll hear the state government omnibus and merge the two bills using the state government bill, House File 1952, as the vehicle. So Chair Eklund, I believe, is on the call now, but the plan was to have Representative Zhang present the Veterans and Military Affairs omnibus as both the co-author and the vice chair of that committee. And if for some reason that is changing at all, Chair Eklund, you can just feel free to let staff know, and we can hand over the reins when the time comes for that. So with that, the chair will move that House File 752 before the committee be up for consideration. So Representative Zhang, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about the budget bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. The 2021 Omnibus Veterans and Military Affairs bill funds the Department of Veteran Affairs and the Department of Military Affairs. It contains about 10 policy bills that were considered by the Labor and Veterans Committee. This bill takes big steps in addressing perhaps the two greatest threats to veterans, suicides and homelessness. This bill dedicates nearly $8 million in new general fund spending to address these dual scourges. The bill provides resources to making housing vouchers available to every eligible homeless veteran in the state and creates an office at the Department of Veterans Affairs dedicated to preventing suicides. Overall, the DVA is funded with $168.5 million in direct appropriations from the general fund in fiscal year 22-23 and $6 million in statutory appropriations. The Department of Military Affairs, meanwhile, receives almost $49 million from the general fund plus $4.4 million in statutory appropriations. The bill provides $23 million in fiscal year 22 and $22.3 million in fiscal year 2023 to veterans programs and services at the DVA. This includes grants, funding for grants to veteran organizations, outreach and case management for veterans, veteran cemeteries, and funding for counseling, such as LinkVet. Overall, the omnibus bill increases general fund appropriations to the Department of Veterans Affairs by $16.7 million over base funding in fiscal year 22-23. The biggest chunk of this is for operating adjustments for the five veterans' homes in the state. This $7.6 million in additional funding represents a 6.6 increase, and this increase is necessary to maintain the level of service delivery at the veterans' homes, which have seen costs significantly increase as a result of COVID-19. And in preventing homelessness, the second biggest change in the DVA's budget is the $6.33 million in new funding to address veteran homelessness. The Department of Veterans Affairs projects that there are currently about 150 homeless veterans in Minnesota who are not eligible for VA housing services. This $6.33 million in funding will provide housing vouchers and wraparound services for these 150 veterans. The bill also enables Department of Veterans Affairs to work with the state's Interagency Council on Homelessness to identify individuals on the Homeless Veteran Registry and provide them with necessary help. In preventing suicides, the governor's budget and the omnibus bill both proposes $1.65 million in new funding to support efforts to prevent suicide by veterans. This funding would be used to add two FTEs at the Department of Veterans Affairs, who would be devoted to preventing veteran suicides and promoting suicide awareness. The Department of Veterans Affairs also plans on doing an intensive review of records of veterans who have died by suicide to identify trends and warning signs. And in addition, the omnibus bill funds the governor's request for $500,000 in fiscal year 22, a task force to recognize the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attack on September 11, for 2021. This will include publishing a history of the global war on terror, developing a traveling exhibition, and hosting remembrance on the anniversary. And then for the proposed funding for the Department of Military Affairs, the increase by $588,000 in fiscal year 22 and 23 All this comes from operating adjustments for two of the Department of Military programs, which represent a 1.1 increase in general fund budget, and also about 1.6 million in special revenue funding from Support Our Troops license plates. And then some of the policy provisions, there's the update to the Military Code of Justice, conforming with the federal changes in 2019, the Veterans Restorative Justice, it creates an alternative sentencing option for veterans who commit certain crimes and who suffer from service-related trauma. For many veterans with PTSD, especially younger veterans, incarceration doesn't help their problems, including substance abuse, mental health struggles, and they're much better served by receiving intensive treatment and avoiding prison. Another policy provision is stable housing for veterans. Also included is a selection of the Adjutant General, and that'll be it, and I'll open up to questions.
Thank you, Representative Jean. So there are no amendments filed to this bill, so we'll go to member question and discussion. And as I mentioned, Chair Eklund was able to join us, so is on the line too. So Chair Eklund, do you want to offer any comment? I know that Representative Zhang just did a great job with the overview, and that was the plan, but being you're here, I'll just nod to you if there's anything you want to add before we go to member question and discussion.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I think Representative Zhang did a fine job, and I wasn't sure if I'd have cell phone service, so I asked him to do it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Edmund. So as mentioned, there are no amendments, so we'll go to discussion, and I see Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as was referenced, and I'm sure everyone knows, we did receive the federal funding for the three veteran homes in Preston, Bemidji, and in my town of Montevideo. And I know that there is some added staffing needed. These are huge projects. And so I think that's a good thing that we have that we're testing to that. And I thank MDVA and the different chairs for addressing that. The one thing I'd like to bring up, though, at this moment, and I guess if Chair Eklund or Vice Chair Zhang could, you don't have to answer a question, but we need to address something as we move the bill forward. I've been notified, and this is not a surprise to me, but I've been notified that as these projects are moving forward, the rules, we talked about the housing bill earlier and some of the difficulties that we have in housing. Well, we're seeing an experience here of a very common problem that I hope we can address on these massive projects. These projects are helpful not only to the veterans, but they're helpful to the communities that they'll be serving, as well as the fiscal influx that'll be coming into these communities on the construction. Unfortunately, the way that the Department of Administration sets forth rules on the bidding process, it effectively, for all practical purposes, shuts out local bidding. And I will tell you that what happens then is we might get some construction companies from the Twin Cities, but more often than not, these projects get almost completely performed by construction companies outside the state of Minnesota. In particular to Montevideo, this is especially sore because for people that don't understand, the state had to put in one third of the construction cost, two thirds, by the feds, and the Montevideo project is almost $40 million. So a third of that had to come from the state. Well, what a lot of people don't know is the people in Montevideo and in that region put in, I think it was about $3 or $4 million. And then there was a private donor who put in another $2 million, a little bit more than that. It was a total of about $6 million locally going into this. And particularly for that $6 million, much less the state of Minnesota taxpayers' money going to other states for other construction companies, just is not acceptable to me. So I'm kind of giving a heads up, and I'm hoping that we can work with that committee. I'm sorry I'm not in that committee this year. I miss it, guys. But I'm hoping that we can address this moving forward. The local guys just want a fair shot at the bids. They don't have to get the work. They just want to have a fair shot at the bidding process. I see Vice Chair Zhang shaking his head, so maybe if he could address this briefly of what we're doing to address that.
Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Miller. I think Chair Eklund might actually be able to answer this one more clearly for you.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Miller, I understand your concern with the local bidders having a fair shot. I agree they should have a fair shot in the bidding process. As far as the extra FTEs that we may need at Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs or Ramrod this brought these projects forward, we have not come up with what the needs are yet. I expect that we will next couple of weeks, and we'll have to see how we can adjust that as we go forward. But we all know how important all these projects are to the not only the veterans of the state, but also the individual communities where these homes will be located.
Representative Miller.
That's all I had, Chair Olson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Eklund, Chair Eklund, and Vice Chair. I appreciate the work in the bill. I had served on this committee in the past, too, and had really enjoyed it. And my son actually is in the military. And interestingly enough, our new representative, Bjorn Olson, had been his commander for many years, and they're stationed right here in Buffalo. So Commander Olson has since moved on to a different commission, but my son is still here in Buffalo and has been in the military, I think, for 7 or 8 years. I've kind of lost track. It just feels like it's always been. But I do miss being on the committee. But to one concern I have in the bill, and this is the addition of Section 11, the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. And I do want to say that this is Representative Feist's bill now, and she and I have worked for hours and hours and hours through some of the concerns that I have. And we're maybe just under half of the way there of my concerns. So I do want to acknowledge that there are many changes to the language here in Section 11 from the underlying bill, from the original language. And I do have a bill of my own that people have been a bit aggressive with me. Some of the veterans groups and so on have not been terribly kind to me, but I do have House File 1098, which is, I would say, most of the way there, although when the Senate had its hearing, they pointed out one issue that I would like to amend if I get a chance to bring that bill forward. But that being said, I wanted to just get on the record some of the concerns that do remain. Like I said, we're just under half of where we need to be to make sure that this bill works for everybody. And as you all know, I am adamantly defending of victims. And so this bill, while it goes in a direction to be a little bit more victim-centered, there's a lot to go. So I just want to briefly mention a couple of my concerns. The first one being that those that would be allowed to be into this diversion program have committed a violent act, including so up to severity level 7. And I know probably very few people even understand what that means, but it could be that would include a domestic assault by strangulation, which means that veteran would have strangled his spouse, his or her spouse, a child that lives in that home, maybe a mother or mother-in-law that lives in that home, a grandmother, anyone that lives within that home. So it's you're talking about strangulation, which means that person that's being strangled is moments from death. So we're talking about an extremely severe violent act. That's where severity level 7 lands. Also, I have concerns with the conditions that are included, which include a traumatic brain injury. And anyone that has worked with those with traumatic brain injury know that that is really difficult to rehab from. So you're talking, so not only PTSD, but they've also included traumatic brain injury, chemical addiction, and so on. So these are pretty severe cases. I used to work at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and we specialized in chronic addiction. And I would label this as a potential of having chronically addicted, traumatically brain injured, very troubled veterans, okay? And the only thing that the judge has to determine before they are ordered to put this person through a diversion program is three factors, and that is that they served in the military, that military service caused this disorder, whether it was a traumatic brain injury or PTSD or addiction, and that there was a causal relationship between that condition and the criminality. So once the judge has ruled by clear and convincing evidence those three factors, then if the defendant, so if the military person says, I want to go through this diversion program, the bill is written right now to say that the judge must allow this. They must go through this diversion program. There is no option for the judge to decline. If the veteran asks, it must be granted as long as those three factors are already met. Now, that's problematic in and of itself. I don't believe that the legislature should be telling the courts that they must enter into this diversion program. So that's also problematic. Now, there's a whole bunch of different things that veteran could go through, and I don't have a problem with the diversity of options, whether it's education or chemical treatment or mental health treatment, other things. My problem with the underlying language as it stands in the bill right now is that in that moment in time when that veteran comes back before the judge, so this is when everything should be completed. So they are at that point where the judge is going to determine what to do with the case. So at that moment in time, there are four factors that the judge has to find. What I find problematic is number one. So the judge only has to say that person successfully participated in treatment, which I don't even know what that means. Either you've completed treatment or you haven't completed treatment. Again, I've worked at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I don't know what it means to successfully participate in something. So basically it says you went to treatment. You could have just sat there, really not done anything. That's what I understand it. Number two, it says substantial compliance to probation. I still don't know what substantial compliance to probation is, because when I ask people that actually are in the field doing this, it could be they're in 50% compliance with probation. One said maybe 75% compliance. One said, I've never heard of substantial compliance. Either they're in compliance or they're not in compliance. So I would like to see that word removed. They need to be in compliance with probation in that moment in time in front of the judge to say that we're going to now dismiss this case. Number three, that they're no longer a danger to others. So I'm not quite sure how the judge is going to determine that they're no longer a danger, particularly when they have a traumatic brain injury, which is incredibly hard to rehabilitate from. So I'm not sure how a judge is going to determine that. There's no meat in there to tell us what that means. And then the fourth factor has to do with that they've participated in a whole bunch of different things, that they've benefited from education, treatment, other things. So I don't have a problem with factor four. I have a problem with factors one, two, and three. And then once the judge determines that they've met these factors, which are very hard to even know what that means, then he would dismiss the charges and dismiss the case and take it even a step further. So then all of that data now becomes non-public data, even to law enforcement, corrections, and probations, and to prosecutors. So in order for those entities to actually see that data, like to do a background check for a gun permit, that is now, they have to get a court order to get that. My fear is that this person could now legally own a gun, a weapon, and I'm really uncomfortable with that. And let me tell you why. So if someone goes through mental health treatment or chemical dependency treatment, it takes them 3 years before the law says, okay, now we can talk about reinstating your gun rights. This is automatic. This is like immediate. As soon as they're in front of the judge and the judge says, we are dismissing all of this, they immediately become a legal gun owner again. I am really uncomfortable with that, and I hope you are too. So I'm going to be, unfortunately, as much as I love the rest of this bill, unfortunately, this bill, Section 11 of the bill, is not ready for prime time. There are significant issues in Section 11. And if you want to know where this bill should be, Section 11, just look to my House File 1098, and it has everything except for one change I would make since the Senate hearing. And that would be the direction that we should go, and not Section 11. So for that reason, I am a no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for that very good explanation of this section, and I wanted to comment briefly on that. I am going to be supporting this portion of the omnibus bill. I think we have I think the way you described it, we're going to be voting this portion out first or something like that. I support this now, but I will tell you that if this section is still the way that it is when it comes to the House floor, I will not be able to support it. I think diversion programs are good, but I want to put a little bit of perspective. My dad was a veteran of Korea. My brother was a veteran. I'm a veteran. I didn't realize behind me I had that photo I forgot that I had that up there. And my son is currently there. And I'm thankful for the military, thankful for the people that have served us. They sacrificed so much. But I was also in the JAG Corps, Staff Judge Advocate Office, legal, and there are many, 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 almost all good service members, but there are also some people that aren't good that are also in there. And I think sometimes what we do is a mistake, and I do this also, is that the word veteran I'm thankful that it's a very positive feeling association with the word veteran, but there are people that do bad things who are also associated with being a veteran. I tell you that I have a long history with the military in my family, but I also have a pretty strong history of domestic violence and sexual assault. And the thing that I'm most concerned about this is the degree to where you can have a crime committed that you can also enter into this. And members, we need to be concerned. Any of those that are prosecuting attorneys that are on this committee, anyone that's been a defense attorney, I fully believe in a vigorous defense, but if they can have someone move, if a defense attorney can move someone into a diversion program, they're certainly going to do that. And I'm very concerned that there are going to be people that would move into this program that should not be. And so I do have faith in our justice system. I do have faith in our courts to address these things and to take into consideration mitigating factors that may be there. I think there is a role for diversion programs. The veterans courts have proven that. The drug courts have proven that. I think there are some things that we can do, but we better be very cautious when we use a tool like this. And I agree with Representative O'Neill that the way that the bill is now written is not there. So I hope we can fix that. As I said, at this time, I'll probably be supporting the portion of Veterans and Military Affairs, but this has to be corrected before it moves much further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion. I see Representative Garofalo, your hand was up, now it's down. I assume you want last word here. So is there any further discussion before we go to Representative Garofalo for the GOP and then Chair Eklund and Representative Zhang? So Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, can you walk us through the process again of how this portion of the bill is going to be traveling either in conjunction with something or something else?
Yep, sure. Representative Garofalo. So right now we have this in front of us. This bill will be laid over and we will take up the state government finance omnibus bill. So 1952, we'll process the amendments on the 1952 bill, and then we would amend this. The bill we're currently on will be on to the 1952, and the 1952 will be the vehicle, and we'll vote for that in its totality.
Okay.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, we will, at that point, would be when we take up the House File 752 as an amendment, that would be the opportunity for us to request a roll call and vote either in favor or against this provision.
Representative Garofalo, that would be appropriate.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, we'll go to Chair Eklund and then Representative Zhang to close with the final word.
Thank you, Chair Olson. And I want to thank Representative O'Neill and Representative Miller for their comments. Veterans Restorative Justice Act bill is a top priority of the Commander's Task Force. MDVA is in support of this portion of the bill, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And as most of you know, I was the chief author last biennium on this. And the reason I have asked Representative Feist to carry it is because some of the legal questions that when I got in front of judiciary, I wasn't comfortable in answering because, frankly, I didn't know the answers, and I don't like being unprepared. I talked to Representative Feist briefly before I went home last weekend about this bill being up, and she's willing to talk more about amendments and how we can fix it to make it right. Her and Representative Medill have come a long ways on this, and I would encourage a conversation. But I'd like to close with, Madam Chair, as we send our young women and men overseas, sometimes they come back with injuries. I think it's our duty to do whatever we can to keep them out of the judicial system, if at all possible. And having had family members that have come through other alternative court systems and seen that it works, I think these diversion courts are a good way to go. So I ask members for support, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. And Representative Zhang, being you did the walkthrough, I'll offer you the final word here, and thank you both for your work on a really great bill. So, Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Eklund did a wonderful job closing up. I just want to mention that, for the Veterans Restorative Justice portion, the bill is supported by county attorneys, defense attorneys, veterans organizations, the courts, and victims groups too. And so I really appreciate the work that Representative O'Neill has been working on this with, along with Representative Feist. And I would encourage everyone's support for this entire bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zhang. So seeing there's no further discussion, I will lay over House File 752. And with that, I believe Chair Moran is back, and I will hand over the virtual gavel to her for the next House file.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson. So our next bill is House File 1952, which is the state government budget bill. We do have a few amendments which we can come back to after the author's presentation. Chair Nelson, would you like to move House File 1952 and be recommended for placement on the General Register? And tell us about your budget.
And Madam Chair and members, I'll move House File 1952 to be placed on the General Register. Members, House File 1952, as the Chair said, is the State Government Finance Omnibus Bill. This is the bill that funds the workings of our state government, from the governor's office and the administrative and executive branches that are underneath him. It also funds the constitutional officers, Secretary of State, State Auditor, and the AG's office. And lastly, probably most importantly to us, is that it funds the legislature. So as we move forward on the bill, that's what it does. Our target was did not allow us to fully fund the governor's recommendations, but we did our best that we could when we did it. Hopefully this bill will pass and we get it to conference so we're able to work out our differences with the Senate. On the policy side of this bill, we included the Secretary of State's administration bill that he's been trying to, some of those issues he's been trying to pass and work through for a few years. Also, the campaign finance bill had an administrative bill, and the minutes had an administrative bill, and there are minor changes in the law, which might make the bill look bigger than it actually is. There's also language in here from the committee that oversees the legislative auditor, some changes and some updates in the language in the legislative auditor's section of law. We are also in this looking towards equity, creating a racial equity working group to look at how we do that in the state on our funding process, and to come forward with recommendations of how to create a racial equity notes similar to our fiscal notes that we have, so that as we're looking at bills and we're looking at the funding of state government, that we look at this through a racial equity lens, that we make sure that bills we pass don't make things worse than they already are, and actually move us in the direction of having our state funding equitable for everybody in the state. Another piece in this where I think helps the racial equity is we're allowing the counties to raise the cap on set aside projects from the current $250,000 cap to $750,000 for DBE, small businesses, and veteran-owned businesses. This will allow these contractors and these businesses to be able to bid on larger projects instead of having a piece of the project, allow them to be the prime contractor on them instead of having to be a sub. And it also will help these businesses to grow and learn how to work with government, how to bid on these jobs and get a bigger piece of the pie. Again, for racial equity, a lot of these smaller contractors are minority-owned and female-owned businesses, and this will allow them to learn the process of working with the government. As we walk through the bill, again, like I said, it has the state appropriations for the funding. It has, I'm trying to think of a couple things I wanted to point out here. Basically, like I said, the staff compensation is in here. Like I said, in the election piece, it's the Secretary of State's administrative bill. Plus, there's a few bills out of here from House File 9. We are bringing forth language for automatic voter registration so that instead of the current process where you have to check a box when you renew your driver's license, this will, your name will automatically forward with a new address to the Secretary of State's office. They will review to make sure that you're eligible to be able to vote, and therefore you won't have to do anything else, but there will be a box to check if you don't want that to happen. We're also trying to make it easier. One of the complaints that we have from a lot of people has to do with people that shouldn't be voting. One of those is people that have done felonies and are getting out of prison and are on probation. Well, members, the little known truth is that eventually these people do get the right to vote back. The problem right now is the way we do this with waiting till they get off paper is that they don't know when they can vote. Sometimes it leads to them mistakenly registering to vote, and that's creating another felony by doing the restore their vote. If they're out of prison, there's a bright line there. If they're in jail or in prison, they can't vote. If they're out of jail, they can vote. This allows these people to be able to move forward and become a part of society, which is what we want to do, make sure that they don't fall back into a life of crime. Again, on the campaign finance side, it's just some cleanup language for them. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to get to the amendments.
All right. So thank you, Chair Nelson. We do have three amendments. Let's see. Chair Nelson, would you like to offer your A4 amendment and explain it for us?
Madam Chair, members, the A4 amendment is something that Representative Claiborne has been working on for the last few years. She had a bill up in the last biennium on this and was working on it. There was some problems between different groups. It's an amendment to add an Indian Day, a country of India day on August 15th. This is the date that they gained their independence from Britain. The current language that's been worked on and worked through with all the diverse groups that make up India, the conversations have taken place to get agreement with them, and this is the agreed upon language from them. And we worked on this with a collaboration with the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, the Posse Caucus, including Representative Vang, Noor, and Hassan, have accepted and agreed with the compromise language. It's focused on the contributions to Minnesota by all the people from Indian ancestry. And like I said, it basically creates August 15th as a day, Indian Celebration Day, which currently they have been meeting at the Capitol, and they've been celebrating that day on their own, but this gives them an official day on the state calendar. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll move House File, or the A4 amendment to House File 1952.
Okay, thank you, Chair Nelson. Members, are there any questions on the amendment? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson. So how does this have to do with finances, the jurisdiction of the Ways and Means Committee? Isn't this a policy amendment?
Chair Nelson.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, yes, it's a policy, but there's policy in our bill. It's also government operations is part of state government finance. This bill was brought to us late. The language has been being worked on. The amendment was brought to us late. We would have done this in committee. but they were still working on the language, and that's why I was asked by powers above me to include this in our bill, and that's why the amendment is being brought forward now.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, where do I apply to be part of this powers that be group that I keep hearing the DFL chairs refer to, these nameless, faceless organizations? So, okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. Appreciate it.
All right. I don't see any further questions. So all those, Representative Nelson renews his motion to adopt the A4 Office Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and an amendment is adopted. Representative Hassan, would you like to offer the A5 amendment and explain it for us?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the A5 in front of the committee. Madam Chair and members, the A5 amendment is a friendly amendment and a minor modification to Article 2, Section 44 of House File 1952. This section creates a working group charged with recommending a racial equity impact note for future legislation. As you can see from the bill language, we're creating a diverse group in which some members may require assistance to attend meetings. Therefore, the A5 amendment allows for the working group to authorize payments. If we truly care about racial equity, then we cannot ask people to carry the burden of working on racial equity issues for free. We must compensate for their time and contribution, as it is imperative for our state to look at racial inequities closely. Chair Nelson has agreed to this minor change, and members, I ask for your support.
Members, are there any questions on the amendment? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the fiscal cost of this amendment?
Representative Hassan.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, roughly $10,000.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions on the amendment? Chair Nelson, any comments?
Madam Chair, yes. What this is going to do is that the LCC, whether the members that are to the commission are paid or not, is the one that oversees this. This will be coming out of the LCC portion of the budget. It does not add to the budget. It just requires the LCC to be able to pay these people. We worked hard. Like I said, we had a tight budget, and we included this in the bill because the group in the bill because we feel it's important. And we've come up with a way, and the LCC has come up with a way to fund the payment of these people to come forward and bring this support issue before the legislature. And I do support the amendment.
All right. So Representative Hassan renews her motion to adopt the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Nash, would you like to offer the A3 amendment and explain it to us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the A3 and I'll request a roll call. Last week, as we were walking through the state government finance bill, talking about the equity impact notes, I heard from the presenter or one of the testifiers actually that the various ethnic councils were not going to be included in creating these impact notes, and I asked in committee why that was, and quite honestly didn't get that great of an answer. I'm hoping that this was an oversight. I think that we can all agree that the various councils are doing really good work. And I myself was just recently appointed to the Council on Asia Pacific Minnesotans as a Republican House member, and have always been just very thoroughly impressed with Ms. Herr and the work that she does. So I would ask, and the amendment moves, that they be included participants in the creation of those. And, it's got no fiscal note, so would ask for your green vote.
Okay. Members, are there any questions on the amendment? Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I support this amendment with Representative Nash. The only question I have is, he listed the amendment puts three of the four minority councils on the committee. The one that was left out was the Indian Affairs Council. I was wondering if from Representative Nash, is that an oversight or was that purposely done?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Nelson, no, that was not an oversight and it wasn't intentional beyond to be vindictive. It was that they're a sovereign nation and I didn't have the ability to necessarily include them as such. We did talk about it with staff. I'd be happy to put them in as a friendly amendment if you would like to. I'm sure we can have nonpartisan staff include that as a friendly amendment, but not having the ability to dictate how a sovereign nation operates, I didn't want to move forward in that way.
I'm going to allow Representative Becker-Finn to make a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just say I think it would be appropriate to add the Indian Affairs Council. I really appreciate Representative Nash thinking about it that way because it's been a long time coming for folks to even realize that we have sovereign nations. But I think it's okay to appoint a position within this bill from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, since the Indian Affairs Council is separate, you know, it's made up of representatives from our tribal nations, but because it is a state council, I think that it would be appropriate to add it if that would be okay with Chair Nelson.
Chair Nelson.
Madam Chair, I would welcome that addition to the amendment. I think that's would round it up. Again, that would add one more member to the working group, but we do need the impact in the input from them. And so I would accept that. I don't know if Mr. Gehring is on the line. If that can be done with just a simple voice addition or modification to the amendment, or if we need to when this moves to the floor, have a floor amendment at the House to add the Indian Affairs Council in there, which is the easiest way of doing this.
Yes, is that Mr. Gehring?
Yes, I believe.
Yes,
I don't.
Yes, could you give us some clarification around the best way to move this oral motion amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, Matt Gehring from Cost Research. I think I would suggest probably drafting this up as a written amendment. It is the concept is simple, but because it's adding to the structure of the membership of the working group, the way we would structure the words is a little bit more complicated. So I might suggest working on a drafted amendment.
Chair Nelson.
So Madam Chair and Representative Becker-Finn and Representative Nash, why don't we do this as a floor amendment? I give you my word that we will do that and add them in. I see Representative Becker-Finn's put her thumb up, but I do support the amendment and I think we should, this is a common sense addition to this that we already have these councils that work on issues and are supposed to advise the legislature and the governor's office. That having them on this committee to look at the racial impact of our spending would be a good thing.
All right. So with that,
Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do appreciate the input from Representative Becker-Finn. Wanted her to know that I did indeed think through the impact of adding that and wanted to be respectful. But I do see the value of these councils, and I do think that if you're going to go down the road of doing these racial impact notes, that you should include something that we, one, are already paying for, and two, have great expertise in the liaison between government and that ethnic community. So I will pull my amendment and offer it with one addition. Understanding that you are all universally on board with that. So with that, I will withdraw my amendment.
Okay, so just for clarity, Representative Nash is pulling his amendment. I think I heard Chair Nelson say this is something that we can bring to the House floor and do a vote on it as a complete all four councils on the floor. Is that correct, Representative Chair Nelson?
We could either do his amendment today and then add the fourth council on the floor, or we could do all four at once. I guess that either way works for me, whatever Representative Nash wants to do.
Well, with that, Madam Chair, I would not withdraw this amendment, and then I will make an additional amendment to put the fourth council on. So I still ask for this, and given that everyone seems to be on board, I will withdraw my request for roll call.
Okay. So Representative Nash renews his motion to adopt the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, are there any questions for Chair Nelson or the nonpartisan staff on this bill? Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Nash has his hand back.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as the Republican lead on state government finance, I would ask first if Chair Nelson could tell us, I guess we've seen included in this several election provisions that are really, quite honestly, going against the age-old process that we've had of having elections provisions be bipartisan. And I'm wondering if that was something that was, as Representative Garofalo has said, given above on from on high, or if we are just to begin no longer having the quaint idea of elections policy being created as a bipartisan effort.
Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nash. Moving forward, as this bill gets into conference, hopefully we can get bipartisan support on the election portions of the bill. And that'll be worked out in conference. This bill matches up with with Senator Kiffmeyer's bill, which also has many items in there that are controversial and not supported totally. So whatever bill comes back, when the bill comes back from conference, whatever election language is in the bill will be something that will have been supported by both parties.
Representative Nash.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I once again would like to point out to members here on the committee call that there is a very stark contrast between bicameral and bipartisan. We are the House of Representatives, and I would point out that the creation of an elections bill that does not move out of our chamber heading over to the Senate is something that is what is expected. We should be putting forward bipartisan policy as it heads over to the Senate, because, you know, I quite honestly, on most days, I'm not overly concerned with what the Senate is doing on their own. I'm charged with doing my job as a member of the House of Representatives. And this distinction that you're trying to make or nuance is not one that I agree with. We should be doing bipartisan elections policy. And there are a great number of things that are really not even close to being bipartisan. And we have fought them in committee. We have talked about, you know, our opposition to motor voter. We've talked about some of the felon restorative voting being somewhat supported, but, you know, still not a hugely bipartisan effort. You know, we've got various things in here that are trying to change elections law that you can use a medical bill to create residency when a medical bill actually doesn't show residence at all. So just this part alone, I think, is really a lack of good judgment on behalf of the majority party trying to nuance it so that we can say that we have what the final bill will be after conference committee is bipartisan. That's not our concern in the House. We should be doing bipartisan work here. So I guess, Chair Nelson, you know, we're back to what we had the last biennium of hyper-partisanship in the elections portion of this bill, and I find that regrettable. Moreover, Madam Chair, if you would, I'll just bring forward some problems with the bill from the state government finance minority leads position. You know, we're seeing a lot of spending in, as the chair said, constitutional officers. And actually, the first run through that we had was with the state auditor, who told us in committee that she needs more money to do more things, but has buildings across the state that she has to continue paying rent for that sit completely empty because of the governor's orders to work remotely. So we're going to pay for a building that we're not using, which seems preposterous. And she actually shared what I know to be a misnomer, that there would be penalties for out clauses in the contract, and the state can actually get out of a contract without a penalty regarding that. You know, moving on to the Attorney General's office, the Attorney General told us that he needed more money to effectively sue more bad actors to protect Minnesotans. But here is the stark reality, not just for the state auditor, the Attorney General, but also for the Secretary of State. They are seeing increases of at least, $11 million for the Attorney General, $3 million for the state auditor, and $1.8 for the Secretary of State. Members, my message in committee and my message here and my message on the floor will be, we are trying to, or the majority is trying to fund agencies and constitutional officers with more money. And that's going to come out of the taxpayer's wallet. The taxpayer is still reeling from COVID. We are still hearing from people on Main Street, Minnesota, and I talked to a lot of them last week in preparation for this. They would rather you leave them and their tax and their checkbooks alone because they are still bouncing back from COVID. They don't feel like the Attorney General needs to go out and sue more people on their behalf and have to have more money in order to do so. You know, we're seeing more money for the Department of Admin. We're seeing more money for MMB. We're seeing more money, more money, more money. There are a great many provisions in this bill that are just throwing money at places that have precious little accountability. And I will point out there's a $139,000 increase over base for the Board of Cosmetology, who currently is being audited by the OLA for a profound lack of efficiency. And that should not go unnoticed, members. We are going to give them more money when they're being audited on how they handle and spend their money. This is just crazy. You know, I guess given my statement on the Senate just a second ago, the $5 million cancellation of the Senate's carry forward, you know, while it's always fun to poke the stick into the bear that is the Senate, I will tell you this is just a shift in the gimmick to give the chair $5 million to spend on something else. You know, we have multiple provisions in here that have zero support from our side of the aisle on the political aspects of the elections, because it is what you're trying to do. It is a hyper-partisan political effective move. And, you know, you move on to some of the policy issues. You know, we talked about housing just a little while ago with Chair Hausman. And in here, you've got the inclusion of House File 1350 from Representative Bolden that allows Rochester and Duluth to change park dedication fees. Park dedication fees ultimately get wrapped into the cost of a house that's being built. That is going to drive up the cost, and they, particularly the city of Rochester, are hot off a brand new referendum, about $2 million, where they levied new money to create new parks, and now they want the ability to create more parks without oversight. And lastly, I will point out that the Chair Mason from the subcommittee on the political division or subdivision compensation limit repeal is asking for cities now to be able to pay administrators or staff a greater amount without coming to the state. And I will tell you, having been a former mayor, this is not a something that I think the state should walk away from, because it is not exactly that onerous. But members, there are piles of provisions in here that are bloated spending on agencies that really should be finding ways to do more with their base budget. We heard in committee last week from a couple of different commissioners that if they only had their base budget, they could continue doing the job that they are charged with. So with that, members, I urge an absolute no vote on this bill. There are many provisions in here that I think are okay, and I appreciate the chair's inclusion of them in working with me as the minority lead. But this bill spends money that we don't have to do things that we don't need to do. that come out of the pockets of Minnesotans who would rather keep that money in their own wallet so that they can continue to strive to stay afloat if they are a business owner, because they wake up every day trying to figure out, how will I make it through today? So with that, I would encourage a no vote.
All right, and I would just allow, if there's no further discussion, to give the last word to Chair Nelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and there's a lot of good things in this bill. And one thing I did forget to mention, as we were talking about, is we are putting in statute the executive order that the previous two governors have had, and I believe it goes back farther than that, to recognize the tribal nations as individual nations. That currently are doing that by executive order, but this puts that executive order in statute. That's another piece of the equity part of this bill. And with that, members, I ask for your yes vote.
Okay. Well, before we take a vote, members, we now have a series of motions and votes to merge two bills together and send them to the General Register. We have Chair Eklund, who would like to make a motion. So Chair Eklund, would you like to move that the language contained in House File 752 be incorporated into the State Government, Veterans, and Military Affairs Omnibus Bill as separate articles?
That is my motion. That is my motion, Madam Chair.
So the motion is before us, and this will be a voice vote. Does everyone understand the motion here? You know, you raise your hand if not. Okay.
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Garofalo had expressed interest in a roll call on this vote.
He won a roll call. Okay.
But he can clarify that.
Okay. So I see Representative Miller hand is up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be very quick about this. Just needs to be said in ways and means. We both parties have done this over the years, but merging into these rather large bills that are across many different borders and territories in spending in Minnesota, we really should not be including this many things in one bill. I know that we're going to be doing it, but I think it should be said that we really should be looking at these items individually. Thank you.
Okay. So just to a check-in, Representative Garofalo, are you doing a roll call on this? Representative Garofalo? Okay, well, we're going to
move on. Madam Chair, this is Representative Nash.
Yes, Representative Nash.
I'm not sure where Representative Garofalo went off to, but I will request a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Nash. So the motion is before us again, and we will do a roll call. And so, Ms. Sparkman, would you take the roll?
Chair Moran?
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
Aye.
Garofalo, aye. Representative Albright, excused. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
No.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha?
Kreisha, no.
Kreisha, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Nor I. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg, excused. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
Aye.
Scott, aye. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. 20 ayes and 7 nays.
So there have been 20 ayes and 7 nays. The motion prevails in House File 1952 as amended.
Madam Chair, sorry, that's not the motion that we just hit the roll call on.
That is not the roll call.
That was the roll. The roll call was to incorporate the language of House File 752 into the omnibus.
So that motion has passed.
Correct.
Yes. Did we get that, everyone? The motion has prevailed.
There's a question from Representative Scott.
Yes, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really wasn't totally clear on what we were voting on. Were we voting on, Madam Chair, to add the veterans bill onto the state gov finance bill? Is that what the vote was, the motion?
Yes, Representative Scott. Yes.
Okay.
And Representative Nash asked for a roll call on that motion.
Okay. Well, is it appropriate then to change my vote from aye to no then?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please note. Thank you.
So noted.
All right. So.
Would you please repeat what the vote count is then with that change?
So the vote call, okay, Representative Spark, should I do that? There was 19 ayes and 8 nays. Is that correct, Ms. Sparkman? Yes.
Yes, Chairman.
Okay. All right. So is there any further discussion on the bill? In entirety, let me see, where are we here?
Madam Chair, the next motion would be to incorporate the language of House File 1952.
So, Chair Nelson, do you move that the language of House File 1952 as amended be incorporated into the State Government Veterans and Military Affairs Omnibus Bill as separate articles? Chair Nelson.
Madam Chair, that's my motion. Sorry, I was muted.
Okay. So the motion is before us. Is there any further discussion on incorporating that as amended, that language into the State Government of Veterans and Military Affairs Omnibus Bills as separate articles? So all those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Finally, Chair Nelson renews his motion that House File 1952, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. This will be a roll call. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright, excused. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha?
No.
Kreisha, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg, excused. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. 18 ayes, 9 nays.
So there being 18 ayes and 9 nays, the motion prevails. House File 1952, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register, and nonpartisan staff are directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. I want to thank Chair Nelson and Representative Zong for bringing this bill forward. So thank you. So our next bill up, and I believe this is our last bill, is House File 993, which is the Higher Education Budget Bill. Chair Bernardi, I understand that you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move that your bill to be recommended for placement on the general register and tell us about it, and then we can come back to your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. In an unprecedented year of a global pandemic, it's no secret that our students have been hit especially hard. We crafted together a higher education budget that serves students now and in the future. Minnesota students deserve the opportunity to achieve their dreams and provide economic security for themselves and their families. We're investing in Minnesotans so they can thrive and emerge stronger post-COVID-19. Notably, our bill holds tuition flat at Minnesota State, increases funding to the state grant program, which will impact over 75,000 students, prioritize financial support for people of color and American Indian students studying to become teachers, which is an important tool in helping close the opportunity achievement gap in Minnesota, provides mental health resources and student support. It protects student consumers from fraudulent practices of for-profit colleges, and it includes numerous equity provisions that I will highlight after our nonpartisan staff walks through the spreadsheet with the changes.
All right. So, Chair Bernardi, she moved House File 993, and she recommended it to be placed on the general register. Would you also now like to move your A12 author's amendment and explain it to us?
Sure. I will move the A12 amendment, and it is technical changes regarding the concurrent enrollment. And then we, the Office of Higher Education, ran the numbers, and we had an opportunity to be able to change the language to increase the living and miscellaneous expenses from in-law, which currently is in-law at 106, we were proposing 110, and now we're able to move to 113%, and reducing the assigned family responsibility for independent students with and without children by reducing it by 1%.
All right. Members, are there any questions on the amendment? Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Bernardi. I do appreciate this session and being able to work with you, and you have really heard my concerns. And it was funny because this was, I think, one of my closing comments about trying to make it even a little bit easier for students and lowering their costs, and that's basically what you're doing here. I just want to clarify that this, in fact, does not change your overall, so you're still staying within your target of $120 million over base. And maybe just explain just a little bit for those listening about what you mean that there was an opportunity. I'm assuming that some calculation was done and you were able to change these numbers but still stay within the target. If you could just clarify that. Thank you, Chair Bernardi.
Okay.
Thank you,
Chair Bernardi.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and it has been a pleasure on this committee with you, and I appreciate your and your caucus's involvement in drafting this actually bipartisan bill that we ended up passing in committee. And to go a little bit deeper is what the Office of Higher Education reran their numbers to take into account the federal changes to the federal Pell grant dollars, as well as the tuition freeze for Minnesota State. And that amount of money was able to be given broader to students through the state grant program, and that was approximately $18 million.
Okay. Representative O'Neill, is there a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think her audio broke up, but I think she said it was a change of $18 million, which actually is quite a bit. So I'm just wondering if you could tell us where you're adding that into. Just explain the $18 million really quickly.
Right. Part of that is for the living and miscellaneous expenses, and it was 106% in law, and the amount went to 110% last year, and we made that permanent, and we were able to up it to 113%. That's where a lot of the money is appropriated in this amendment. And then we also put in reducing, like I said, the student family responsibility for independent students. And if you'd like any more deeper information about that, we can call on OP.
Yeah. So Representative Neal, House Fiscal staff will be walking through the bill if you need more clarity. They will be doing that. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just wait for that. Thank you so much. I wouldn't have asked, but it came kind of at the last minute, and I haven't had a chance to dig into the spreadsheet, so I appreciate that going through here. Thank you.
Okay. So Chair Bernardi renews her motion to adopt the A-12 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed. All opposed. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. There's also an A-13 amendment that's been filed. Will someone be offering that amendment?
I will be, Madam Chair.
Okay, Chair Bernardi.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. This amendment was, the idea was brought to us by Representative Erickson in our committee, and I worked on it further and worked with our nonpartisan staff as well as Office of Higher Education and the student organizations. And we were able to come up with an amendment that gives the Office of Higher Education a larger role and preserves the Student Association role in awarding our Hunger-Free Campus grant.
Are there any questions to the A-13 amendment? So on the motion, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly for my members, I support this amendment. This is very similar to something that we had offered in committee. Instead of having the student organization actually, it says review designated grant applications and provide final approval for the grant disbursement. Instead of having a student association do that, instead they're doing it in coordination with the Office of Higher Education, which I feel is much more appropriate, and I would support the amendment.
Okay. So with that, Chair Bernardi again renews. So on a motion to adopt the A-13th amendment, we're going to take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So with that, why don't we turn this over to our House Fiscal staff, our nonpartisan staff, to do a walkthrough of the spreadsheet.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Ken Savory, House Fiscal staff. I'll be taking you through the spreadsheet, and I believe that Mr. McCall will be sharing the spreadsheet that was posted on the website momentarily, and that appears to be happening. So I'll go ahead and start.
The first changed item is on line 24. This is an increase to the state grant program, an increase of $6.3 million above the base. This takes into account the changes in the A12 amendment. So this increase and thus the appropriation is identical to the DE amendment that left the House Higher Education Finance Committee last week. So there's no change in that appropriation other than the change that was adopted by the committee. So the $6.3 million increase. Scrolling down more, you'll see more change items to the Office of Higher Education, which are on line 73 through 88. Line 76 is the increase for the emergency assistance for post-secondary students, $1.3 million increase over base. Line 77 is the direct admissions pilot program, which is $1 million new program in FY22-23, and then the reduction of, and then a reduced TAIL spending of $150,000. Line 78 is the summer academic enrichment program. That is $1 million increase from the base. Line 79 is the ICAP Innovation for College Attendance Program grant. That's a 1.430 increase above the base in FY22-23. Line 80 is an increase to the agency administration appropriation to the Office of Higher Education. That increase is $427,000 in the current biennium, and then $354,000 in the TAILs. Line 81 is the Grants to Teacher Candidates program. This is a reduction due to some language in the bill that separates out who is eligible for the program. So this reduction of $1.5 million is redistributed within the bill to a different program that separates out those that are eligible for certain candidate teaching grant programs. Line 82 is the removal of the dual training competency grants for the Department of Labor and Industry. That's a reduction of $400,000 from the base, which effectively removes it from the bill. Line 84 is the interstate tuition reciprocity appropriation. That's a reduction of $5,036,000 in FY22-23, identically in the TAILs. Line 84 is a new appropriation for the hunger-free campus grants. That is $498,000 in FY22-23, and then $446,000 in the TAILs. Line 85 is a one-time appropriation in FY22-23 of $550,000 for the Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. Line 87 is the Aspiring Teacher of Color Act Scholarships. These are one-time appropriations consisting of $4.5 million in FY22-23. And then line 88 is the grants to underrepresented teacher candidates. This is the reduction from the Grants to Teaching Candidates program plus additional funding from the target. So that new funding in FY22-23 is $4,921,000. And then additionally in the TAILs, funding of $5,256,000. And then line 88 is some additional reductions for administrative cancellations. Scrolling down more to the next agency, which is Minnesota State. The Minnesota State changes for the system are on line one, begin on line 121. And this is an increase to the operations and maintenance, or O&M, of $64.5 million in FY22-23. And then additionally in the TAILs, $86 million in total. Line 122 is the Supporting Students' Basic Needs Appropriation. This is a $2.5 million increase above the base to the operations and maintenance. Line 123 is the Z-degree textbook program, or Z-degree textbook program. That's a $500,000 one-time increase in each year, so $1 million above the base. Line 24 is for mental health services. This is a permanent increase of $100,000 in each fiscal year. And then on line 125 is the Career and Technical Education Pilot Program. This is a $400,000 increase one time in fiscal year 22. In total, the MinState has increased appropriation from the general fund of $68,600,000 in FY22-23. And then finally, the last set of changes per the bill are for the University of Minnesota. On line 150 is the operations and maintenance increase. That is $39,750,000. And then the tails, that is $52 million above the base for the operations and maintenance. Additionally, for the U of M, there was a change to one of the state special appropriations. Line 162 is the system special, and correspondingly on line 166, the appropriation for the state system special was increased by $1 million in each fiscal year. Specifically, there is language in the bill that targets that increase to NRI for research purposes. And Madam Chair, that concludes the changes within the spreadsheet and of the higher education bill.
All right, members. So members, are there any questions for Chair Bernardi or the nonpartisan staff on the bill? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just looked really quickly at the end number, and if I, you know, as Mr. Savory was looking through it, and it said 125 million was the total above base, and maybe I'm not seeing that correctly, but I thought the target was 120 million. If either Mr. Savory or if Chair Bernardi could speak to that.
Okay, Mr. Fiscal Staff.
Madam Chair and members, the spending above base is, yes, $125,340,000, but the net impact on the general fund is $120 million. There is $5,340,000 of reductions in fiscal year 21. So when you combine fiscal years 21, 22, and 23 changes, that is a net impact to the general fund of $120 million.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And then also in the line item talking about what's normally a transfer from OHE to DALI, and it's about the dual training program. If I remember correctly in presentation in committee, so you're removing 400,000 as a transfer, but is that also now going to be just under the DALI budget? So it we're not eliminating it. It's just we're not doing the transfer. Is that correct?
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, yes, the appropriation will no longer be within the higher ed portion, but I believe it still will exist within the labor area.
Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good. Yeah, I just want to make sure we get that on the record because long ago, I think it's back in 2015, I was working with then Senator Bonoff, and we worked on the dual training program and did a lot of work to that. And I would say that the language of this bill actually improves it and kind of reverts it back to what we had back in 2015 in some areas, but it's some good changes. Would it be appropriate to speak to the whole of the bill at this point, Madam Chair?
Well, before you do that, I do believe, well, let me see. Chair Bernardi, would you like to speak more to your bill now, or would you like to speak after Representative O'Neill?
Well, Madam Chair, if you wouldn't mind me pointing out the different, the Select Committee on Racial Justice has made a number of recommendations, and I wanted to highlight some of those in our bill. Would you like me to do that now or after?
Why don't we do that now, because Representative O'Neill may have some questions to that also.
Okay, thank you very much. And I will try to narrow down my remarks because of the time. But the Select Committee on Racial Justice made a number of recommendations that we included in this bill. Recommendations included support for teachers of color and American Indian teacher supports, which included, and their recommendations was to increase investments in recruiting, training, retraining, and promoting teachers of color and indigenous teachers through scholarships, implement stipends for paid student teaching opportunities to address income inequity challenges and create barriers to diversify our pipeline for future teachers. We were able to, from the work we did in 2019, we already had $750,000 per year available for underrepresented teacher candidate grants. And by incorporating the language this year from Representative Keeler, we increased the teacher of color and indigenous teachers candidate grants by $3.421 million for the biennium. And we also funded an aspiring teacher of scholarships for the first time for $4.5 million for the
Enium, and that's a pilot program. There's a number of, we've changed other things in that area as well, but I will move on to the Select Committee on Racial Justice higher education recommendation that would increase funding for youth apprenticeships and work experience. In this bill, we included a provision that would require the Office of Higher Education to conduct a study of a work study program and analyzing how that program could be expanded to meet the needs of college students and enable more students to work on campus and focusing on our BIPOC students as well. And then we also implemented measures that Representative Knorr was a part of. We have an intervention for college attendance program that we increased funding for. We have a summer academic enrichment program. And then we had, the other recommendation was in career technical education that the Select Committee on Racial Justice made on higher education. And that is to increase access to technical and trade college courses in high school. And Representative Pawlowski has a pilot program in this bill, and it's $400,000 to create a pilot project to develop more career and technical instructors to help more students across the state graduate with an employable skill or certificate in the trades or manufacturing. Currently, a massive shortage of instructors in this area and a rapidly growing demand, especially among women and students of color and Indigenous students. And then the other area that was recommended by the Select Committee on Racial Justice was to provide access to free post-secondary remedial classes. And we were able to put language in this bill so that exempt any credits from taken that were developmental education from counting towards the credit limit for the state grant program. And then the other recommendation from the Select Committee on Racial Justice made higher education recommendations related to emergency funds for students. In our bill, we have support student basic needs at the Minnesota State, emergency assistance for post-secondary students, and extending child care grant eligibility and increasing awards. And then other provisions I just want to mention, I already talked about the state grant program, and then our Hunger Free Campus grants, and which provides a process to grant awards from the Office of Higher Education for campuses to establish on-campus food shelf program. And this was brought by our Students Association, and we have now moved that to throughout all our colleges in the state. So thank you for all the members of our committee to make this a robust bill to help all of our students across the state.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Great work. So with that, I'm going to pass it back on to Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Moran. I just have a quick question for Chair Bernardi. And when we were doing the committee work, I believe that we landed at still $113,000 above what the governor asked, above what the agency asked for the for OHE, for the Department of Higher Education. And I'm just wondering, I didn't hear in your explanation as to why we're going above their ask. And I'm wondering if you could explain to the committee here why we're doing $113,000 above what the agency ask was.
Chair Bernardi.
I want to defer that to the Office of Higher Education. Okay. The intent was to do their request.
Okay, we have someone here from the Department of Higher Ed. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Manager of Grants and Government Relations for the Office of Higher Education. The 113, my understanding, is due to the added reports that are currently in the bill for transfer and work study. So I think the way they accounted for that was within the agency admin.
Okay, thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have another question for Chair Bernardi. In the bill, you have frozen tuition for Minn State, and they expressed some concern in freezing tuition because obviously Minn State has two options for revenue, and that's state funds or tuition. And so freezing tuition, and then also, obviously, we have a limited amount of money that we can provide puts them kind of in a difficult position. And I'm wondering if they're here and just could get on the record again, what the impact will be on their institution, or if they would be raising mandatory fees or, you know, raising revenue somewhere else.
Okay.
If they can answer that.
Yeah. So please, this is someone from higher ed who can respond to that.
Madam Chair, I don't believe we have any representatives from Minnesota State, so this may be a question for the chair.
Okay, Chair Bernardi.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I can't answer for Minnesota State, but this is something we said that with the federal dollars that are coming in, our goal of our bill was to help make sure students were invested in currently and in the future. And so we don't know all the end results of what's going to happen with the federal dollars, and we can revisit this if needed, but our goal is to help our students be able to hold down to tuition as well as preserve the opportunities that they have.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My final comment would be I have still great concerns about the direct admissions program that we're adding in here, and this is the governor's initiative, but essentially, we are creating an entire system to tell a senior that, hey, by the way, did you know that because you graduated from high school here in Minnesota, that you are able to have admission into one of our two-year campuses through Minn State? And so it just seems like $1 million of kind of wasted money. I mean, we could certainly find a cheaper way and more efficient way to let a senior in high school know that, hey, you can, if you graduate from a high school here in Minnesota, be admitted into a two-year college at Minn State. And I think we could spend $1 million a lot better. And you know, this is creating an entire system, so it's not just a one-time appropriation. It's going to be something that will be ongoing. So I still oppose that in this bill. The remainder of the bill is pretty good. There's some interesting new initiatives, and I support the rest of it, but I still would like to see the direct admissions part removed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Neal. Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, I just want to acknowledge and thank Chair Bernardi for working to address the racial equity challenges that we face at our post-secondary. Chair Bernardi, you and I, you know, had early conversations even prior to the session about that, and as you began to hold your hearings, and a number of colleagues that I work with in the nonprofit education world have participated with you and with other legislators as well on this issue. We do have some real challenges in this state. We continue to have some pretty big disparities in terms of post-secondary, realizing post-secondary opportunities in many of our communities of color, Black, Indigenous, Latino, and good chunks of our Asian Pacific Islander communities as well. And I think your bill moves in the right direction in terms of addressing some of the very practical barriers that exist in these communities, particularly economic barriers. I'm really thankful for the amendment that you offered at the very beginning of this hearing, doing, among other things, adjusting the LME. Having a student financial aid approach that is aligned with the stark realities of economic disparities that exist in our state, this is vitally important to be able to expand opportunity. And of course, if we don't do that, we're not only going to continue to perpetuate diminished opportunities in these communities, we're also increasingly going to hurt our state. And so, anyway, just a very quick acknowledgement of these important steps, and look forward to us continuing to hone in on how to both deliver financial frameworks as well as strong student support frameworks that can really maximize opportunities for these communities.
Okay, thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In closing, a question for the author of the bill. Is the author of the bill aware of how much federal money will be coming going to our higher ed institutions from the federal stimulus bill?
Chair Bernardi?
We could probably, well, I'll just tell, it's over $500 million that's coming to the state, and half of that, those dollars go directly to the students, and half go to the colleges to be spent on COVID-related dollars. As we understand now, there is not guidance out yet on how those dollars can be spent.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and Chair Bernardi, do you anticipate the legislature having any involvement at all in prioritizing or allocating those resources?
Chair Bernardi.
At this time, we are uncertain how we the role that we would play. It's right now they are going directly to the students and then to throughout our state at our different colleges and universities for that for them to make their decisions on that.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and Chair Bernardi, in addition to the $552 million that's going to higher education institutions, as you described, there's also an additional over $2.5 billion that is going to the state that is highly discretionary. It's not specifically, it's not as prescribed as the federal, the higher education money we described earlier. Do you anticipate that the those in the higher education arena will be seeking to have any of those resources allocated to the higher education arena?
That is unclear at this. Thank you, Madam Chair. That is unclear at this point in time. We have had conversations with the Office of Higher Ed on possibilities on how those dollars could be spent. They are likely limited in the Office of Higher Education area. So that's what we know as of right now.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Bernardi. Just a final question. So if there were to be allocations made to higher education out of that discretionary fund, that $2.57 billion, is the legislature going to have any formal process in allocating those funds?
Chair Bernardi.
That is something that I would defer to Speaker Hortman.
Okay. So, Madam Chair and members, I do want to highlight that once again, at the federal level, there is $8 billion in federal money that's being sent to the state of Minnesota. Some of this is in alignment with what we've done in the past with federal funds, where a part-time legislature doesn't need to just reinterpret federal law. We allocate that funds. I don't think there's much of a dispute around that. But I would just ask members of both sides to take a look at the federal guidance and to look and notice that right now there's $2.7 billion in very discretionary funds that the Congress has given to the state to the states. As I mentioned earlier, $2.57 billion is the state fiscal relief fund. There's also $178 million that's in the capital projects fund. And right now, when the bell rings on the end of the legislative session, the governor is going to take all that money and spend it the way he wants. And the legislature will have a purely advisory role in that. So we've had this discussion in this committee before. The majority has decided to prohibit its finance chairs from even allowing them to spend or prioritize any of that federal money. So even if Representative Bernardi did have something she wanted to use those federal funds on, she's prohibited from rule by even doing that. So I would hope that members of the DFL, either publicly or privately, take a more aggressive standpoint and take a look at these things and making sure that we're not just allowing the governor to unilaterally spend over $2.7 billion the way he wants. So because of the lack of involvement in federal issues and other issues, I'm voting no on this bill today, and I would strongly encourage members on my side of the aisle to do the same. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion to the bill? Any other questions? I'm not seeing any. Okay, well, what I would like to do is just really want to thank Chair Bernardi for her work. We know how important higher education is for those who are attending those institutions and the impact it will have on, you know, their, let's just start with the income level. So I just want to thank Chair Bernardi for your strong support of our college students. And just also just lift up in the many provisions that you had within your bill, your equitable provisions that you had within your bills and all our chairs, that I was able to hear how we're going to work to ensure that we are creating equity across the state of Minnesota, within our, especially within our diverse communities. And for Chair Bernardi, your intentional reference of the recommendations that came from the Select Committee on Racial Justice, I think is a great opportunity just to move our state forward. And so with that, I want to offer last words to Chair Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your words, and I just want to just, before I wrap up, just thank all the people who came and testified this year in our unusual circumstances of Zoom. We opened our table to people, our students, our faculty, our administrators of our colleges and universities, and our members shared their stories, and we had robust conversations and really heard from Minnesotans, and so we could put their needs into this bill and make sure that we can do all we can to help them be successful in the completion of their credentials.
So there being no further discussion, Chair Bernardi renews her motion that House File 993, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register, and that the nonpartisan staff be directed to make any necessary technical corrections. With that, Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright, excused. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye.
Bernardi, aye.
Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha?
Kreisha, no.
Kreisha, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg, excused. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. 18 ayes, 9 nays.
So there have been 18 ayes and 9 nays. The motion prevails in House File 993. As amended, is recommended for placement on the general register, and nonpartisan staff are directed to make any necessary technical corrections. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Well, members, that concludes our agenda for today. We will be back at 9 o'clock tomorrow for the next slate of bills. I want to thank you for your time today. For all, I want to just share that today is Chair Pinto's birthday. Happy birthday, Chair Pinto. Enjoy your day, and all members, enjoy your day. Thank you. We are adjourned.